Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
They do it once a quarter, four times a year, mostly because they have to. Public companies reporting how much money they made or lost in the prior 3 months. First quarter earnings start coming out tomorrow, and nobody is very excited about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargill.com/creates.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Monday. It is the 6th of April today, which means tomorrow is the 7th, which means we're about to get what might be an unwelcome look into the profitability of some big American companies. Tomorrow, Alcoa will be the first to report profits in what's known as first quarter earnings season. Next week, we'll get the banks, which helps explain part of the case of the blahs Wall Street had today, despite recent pronouncements from the likes of J.P. Morgan and Citigroup that they're not doing as badly as everybody thought. There is still a lot riding on the Treasury Department's plan to salvage the financial industry. Remember, this is the plan that's supposed to help banks unload those piles of distressed mortgage-backed securities they've got sitting around. And to that end, fund managers who want in on Secretary Timothy Geithner's public-private partnership now have a little more time. Today, the Obama administration extended the application deadline by a couple of weeks, and it relaxed the standard slightly for those who do want to participate. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott explains Treasury has a lot riding on getting private investors to go along.
The Treasury is looking for about 5 fund managers to run the public-private investment program. They'll raise money from investors and then bid for mortgage-backed securities with financing from the government. Sue Allen is president of Allen Hill. Her firm helps investors buy these kinds of assets. She says the Treasury's initial guidelines excluded all but the biggest managers, like PIMCO and BlackRock.
I think the industry was saying, well, wait a minute, there's a whole lot more talent here and a whole lot more interest that's being excluded. Why should these guys have the first cut? Why can't we participate?
They may be able to eventually. The Treasury said today it could expand the number of managers once the program's up and running. Officials also encouraged small firms and firms owned by women and minorities to partner with the major fund managers. But getting managers on board is only half the battle. Banks want to hold out for the highest price they can get for their securities. Investors want the best deal possible. Getting the two to meet in the middle could be the program's biggest challenge. Mansoor Ghori is head of Accent Capital, a private equity firm in Austin, Texas. He says he'd be interested if the terms were right.
We look at all the programs and see how we can participate. You just have to make sense from an investor's perspective.
Trouble is, it's difficult for investors to know what they might be getting into. The public-private partnership still looks like a work in progress. One insider at a major private equity firm told me no one will know if they'll buy anything until they see the prices. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
While the world has been watching General Motors and Chrysler drive straight into what might eventually be bankruptcy, Ford has taken the path less chosen. The company, which hasn't taken any money from taxpayers, made a big announcement today. It has retired almost 40% of its debt. That's almost $10 billion worth. And it's going to cut about $500 million out of its interest expenses this year. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now on how they did it and whether the competition might be able to follow Ford's lead.
Much of Ford's debt restructuring came down to one thing: cold, hard cash. Ford gave creditors some money. They forgave all of Ford's debt, even though the company didn't pay the whole amount. Shelley Lombard is a senior high-yield analyst with Gimme Credit.
Ford had more liquidity, and it was able to do a cash offer. And as we like to say in the bankruptcy world, it's easy to value cash.
In other words, it's better to get up to 55 cents on the dollar now than to wait even longer for the chance of being paid back in full. There's just something bankable about certainty.
Nobody had to guess at how much the offer would be worth. You knew exactly what you were getting.
Ford got the money from its financing arm, Ford Motor Credit. GM and Chrysler would have a harder time copying that move because they no longer own their financing arms. Ford retired the rest of its debt by converting bonds into stock. GM is trying to do the same thing, but its terms with creditors are different. Lombard says many of GM's bonds weren't supposed to be converted to stock.
So obviously holders of regular bonds who never had any intention of, you know, converting into GM equity are going to have a hard time to say, you know, convert your bonds into equity.
They just want their money back. But in the end, when you're swapping debt for stock, it comes down to the long-term value of the company. Amy Wilson covers Ford for Automotive News.
To be sure, Ford's stock value has declined drastically and, you know, Ford's cash pile is dwindling. But, you know, right now Ford looks much farther away from bankruptcy than GM or Chrysler.
And now perhaps closer to an investment grade rating as the auto industry claws itself out of the valley of debt. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The big merger and acquisitions news of the day is of a deal that seems to have come undone. This weekend, Sun Microsystems said thanks, but no thanks to IBM's offer of $7 billion. Shares of both were down today. Sun's way more than IBM, for whatever that tells you. Almost any help wanted ad is worth a mention the way the economy is going, so it's real news when 2,000 jobs open up. The company doing all the hiring is Sallie Mae, the country's biggest student lender. And our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports that Sallie Mae wants voters to know all about its hiring spree.
Over the next 18 months, Sallie Mae will be signing up call center and information technology workers, all in smaller towns in states such as Pennsylvania, Texas, and Florida. Martha Holler is a Sallie Mae spokeswoman.
These are good jobs. These are jobs that come with benefits, with 401k, with medical insurance, for part-timers, for full-timers. We're pleased to bring them and all of the direct and indirect economic value that a good job brings to a local community.
These jobs were outsourced to the Philippines, India, and Mexico a year ago. Moving them back will cost Sallie Mae $35 million and blow any anticipated savings.
The value of bringing 2,000 jobs back to the U.S. means more to Sallie Mae as an American company than any cost savings that we could achieve by farming the work out overseas.
But some analysts say there might be another message in Sallie Mae's domestic job creation. The Obama administration is proposing to take away most of its lending business. Mark Kantrowitz is publisher of the student loan website FinAid.org.
The lender may also be trying to suggests that if President Obama moves forward with his plans to eliminate the federally guaranteed student loan program and replace it with the 100% direct lending, that may cost the U.S. tens of thousands of jobs across all the lenders.
If Congress approves the Obama budget proposal, Sallie Mae could still compete for contracts to service the government loans and collect payments. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Fear of the unknown kept Wall Street subdued. Today, traders seem to be waiting for those first quarter earnings reports we were talking about. We will have the details when we do the numbers. So today, fewer late flights and fewer people bumped off them, fewer complaints about lost luggage and other hassles. Of course, fewer people flew at all, too. That's probably one reason the airlines managed to do better. Americans are expected to travel less this year, too, as we think twice before spending money. That said, though, everybody needs a break now and then. So to get some sense of how the summer vacation season is shaping up, we sent Marketplace's Sean Cole out of the office.
This is why my job is awesome.
Wow. This is just beautiful.
These buildings all down here. I get to interview Mark Downey on the balcony of his hotel resort in Dennisport, Cape Cod, while gazing out at the ocean on a sunny day. It's two pretty basic hotels, the Corsair and the Cross Rip, $200 or $300 a night in season, so cheaper than a lot of Cape vacations.
We don't say cheaper, by the way. We say cost effective, efficient. You can use, there are many other words you can use.
Downey says they did really well last summer when everyone was driving instead of flying. And he's not expecting a bad summer this year. He's just not expecting a great summer.
Some of those regulars that we have coming every year, they may have gone from a week stay to 5-night stay. Or maybe they went from an ocean front room and they went down to an ocean view room and they reduced the price down.
His advanced booking numbers were off at the beginning of the year, but they're bouncing back now. Same goes for the Cape Codder Resort, a few towns away. It's a little higher end. Bill Catania showed me around.
That's actually a wave pool, shut off right now.
Uh-huh.
What is a wave pool?
It makes waves.
Catania runs a bunch of inns and restaurants in the area, and like everyone else I talked to, he said people are waiting longer before booking their vacations. It reminds him of the months after 9/11, when people didn't want to make any plans.
You know, and then as time went on, they realized the sky's not falling, there is going to be a tomorrow. It's okay to still live.
But it's tough to get a fix on how much living we're all going to do this summer. Last July, a survey by Allstate Insurance said consumers were going to cut their 2009 travel spending almost in half. But that was last July.
Your primary indicator that you would look at to predict what the summer's going to be like would be the Consumer Confidence Index.
Wendy Northcross heads up the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce. She says the Consumer Confidence Index is so low right now, she can barely look at it.
And it belies what I'm hearing from my members, that advanced bookings are actually pretty good. Because I think people are going to shift to a less flashy vacation, an affordable vacation, one that's nearby.
Maybe a single-family house near the beach instead of a resort. And if anybody knows about that market, it's Jeff Talmadge.
Let me check it just so get this right.
He and his wife Joan run the website WeNeedAVacation.com. It's a listing service for single-family house rentals. Jeff says the homeowners will usually start lowering their prices in June if they're not fully booked.
This year, for the first time, especially on the islands, the Vineyard and Nantucket, homeowners are starting to lower their prices already. Definitely there's a nervousness out there that we have never seen, which comes as no surprise, given the economy that we have never seen before.
For a while, one client was offering an early bird discount. Her ad says,
"Recession buster."
Her name's Nikki Lasella. She rents out a four-bedroom house for $2,250 a week in season. But she just dropped the price to $1,950 because she only has 1 week of the summer rented. There's a lot of competition out there, she says.
This woman called me the other day and she said, "Okay, I'll let you know. We're looking at a few places. I'll get back to you."
Wow, so it's really a renter's market right now.
Oh, I think so. Yes, I do.
So in the end, it doesn't seem that we're skipping vacations as much as spending less on them. Another thing Mark Downey, the resort owner, told me is that he's getting calls from people who usually book flashier getaways on the Cape.
So those guests are calling me to say, "Hey, we've always stayed on the ocean. It's just too pricey here. We'd like to come and stay in your place. You offer similar things. You're just not as big."
So you're a beneficiary, actually, of the recession in that way.
In that way, you're absolutely right.
And if Marketplace keeps sending me out to do seaside interviews like this one, I won't need a vacation. On Cape Cod, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
You're probably numb to bad economic news by now, right? After the crash of last fall, watching the stock market nowadays doesn't really bring too much fear, and we're all used to lousy reports on unemployment and gross domestic product. Therapists and mental health professionals would say we have updated our coping mechanisms to deal with the financial ups and downs. Commentator Paul Hellman has a couple of more.
Sometimes, in the middle of work, I wonder, how's the Dow doing? The way you might worry about an unsteady friend who reacts to every single thing that happens and then gives you the math. I was up this morning. Now I'm down, really down. How do you stay up when the Dow goes down? One answer comes from a surprising source, financial advice. Unfortunately, you can't really apply this advice to your portfolio for the main reason that your portfolio no longer really exists. But you can use it to restore perspective. Here's the key principle. Think wide, think long. Think wide. Open any financial guide. What do you read? Diversify. Regrettably, even diversified portfolios have lost money. So maybe it's time to diversify out of money. Let's assume you've already done that, in the sense that you no longer have any. Well, consider your career. My career. Let's see. I'm worried about getting laid off. All right, who isn't? But what can you do about it? How can you take some initiative and stand out? And what's your plan B if you do get laid off? Put something down on paper. Keep it simple. One page. Consider your health. My health. Well, I'm really stressed out by all this financial news. All right, who isn't? But what can you do about it? Can you exercise more? Practice some relaxation techniques? Spend more time with friends, family? Here's the point. Don't put all your concerns in one basket. Sounds odd, but by looking at the broad sweep of your affairs, you compartmentalize any single problem, and maybe you discover one or two things to feel grateful for. Also, Think long. Stock market pros advise against putting money in the market that you'll need before 5 years. Will you be upset about the Dow in 5 years? 5 years. Maybe. All right, how about 10 years? Most problems are temporary, not permanent. In 10 years, I believe, call me optimistic, that we'll have a completely new set of circumstances to worry about.
Paul Hellman is a business consultant. You can send us your thoughts online. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, the science behind retaining your employees.
What are the factors that cause people to think about leaving, even if it's subconsciously, before they actually make the decision to leave?
But first, let's do the numbers. Renewed banking worries pushed the Dow lower 41 points today, 0.5%. The blue chip index closed back below the 8,000 level, 79.75, if you want a real number. The NASDAQ gave back 15 points, nearly 1%, finished at 1606. The S&P 500 trimmed away 7 points, more than 0.75%, wrapped up trading at 835. SunTrust Banks dropped 8%. KeyCorp slid more than 7% today. Wells Fargo lost more than 6.5%. Shares of American Express slipped more than 1%. That after an analyst warned that higher-than-expected unemployment will hit earnings for the big credit card company. Stock in Sun Microsystems plunged 22% amid those reports we told you about its merger with IBM being in trouble. Shares of Big Blue dropped 0.67%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve Board releases the Consumer Credit Report for February. The conservation organization American Rivers releases its annual list of the most endangered rivers. And safe driving is highlighted for National Work Zone Awareness Week. The message, slow for the cone zone. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Controversial performance bonuses aren't reserved for companies that have taken government bailouts. Today, New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo sued a hedge fund manager who funneled more than $2 billion of his client's money to Bernie Madoff. For his superior performance, the fund manager, Ezra Merkin by name, received fees and bonuses totaling $470 million. Interestingly enough, there is some research out there that shows the bigger the bonus, the worse the performance. Behavioral economist Dan Ariely is with us to explain. Dan, good to talk to you again.
Same here.
What do we know about money and how hard we work for it?
Surprisingly little. A lot of money is being spent on compensation, but we actually know very little about it. So together with some friends, we decided to check it out. And we started by checking out the most trivial assumption, the idea that the more money is on the line, people would perform better. We wanted to give people either a small bonus, a medium bonus, or a large bonus. Now, my research budget is not that big, and I wanted the big bonus to be very big, like a six-month salary. So we went to India, and guess what happened? Across many tasks, the more money was on the line, the worse people did.
Say that again. More money, lower performance?
That's right. When we gave them a huge bonus, performance went down.
Why?
So it turns out that money is a two-edged sword. It's a motivator, but it's also a stressor. And beyond a certain point, the stress can overwhelm the performance. So imagine, for example, I said, if you perform well in the next 10 minutes, there's $50,000 in there for you. How well will you perform?
Right. Yeah. Probably not too well, actually, right?
Yeah. And it turns out this is also happens not just with humans. It also happens with rats. So a long time ago, there were some rats who were given a task to learn a maze. And if they learned well, they could either avoid either a small shock, a medium electrical shock, or a huge electrical shock. And unsurprisingly, they did better for the medium shock than on the small shock. They were more motivated and they actually learned faster. But when the big shock was in the question, was on the balance, they actually performed worse. They were so consumed, so terrified from this large shock, they were not able to think about anything else. And it's the same thing that happens to us with money.
So we just get stressed. When we see all that money on the line, we just get stressed and our performance goes down.
That's right. And this is not the worst of it. We did one more thing in the beginning of the experiment in India. We tried to get people very stressed, the most stressed we could with this amount of money we had. So for some people, we gave them the money up front. And we said, look, this is your money. If you don't perform well, we'll take the money back from you. Now, we ran one subject. He was shaking the whole time. He couldn't do anything. He was so stressed. Then we ran it with another guy who was not as shaky. But he, when he didn't make the money, he ran away with all our money at the end. We couldn't catch him. He was so fast.
He just left.
He just left. So we stopped doing it this way. But I think this is actually a good analogy for many people about how they think about their bonuses. They expect them. They anticipate them. And because of that, they even have a more devastating effect on their performance.
Well, is there a way then for managers to think about this and say, well, maybe I should give them some percentage of a bonus, or is there a better way to compensate to maximize performance?
There's all kinds of ways to get the benefit of bonuses without getting the stress connected to them. For example, how about if we gave a bonus quarterly rather than a yearly? Of how about it was the average of the last 5 years rather than just the last performance.
And yet, these guys on Wall Street, just because that sort of seems to be the bonus question of the day, they're getting millions of dollars for losing everybody billions.
I actually went to one of these big investment firms and I presented these results. And I said, guys, why don't we revise how you think about bonuses?
How did that go over? I'm sure that was a great reception you got, right?
They basically said, well, you know, this could happen for other people, but not for us. We're professionals. We know what we're doing. We don't get stressed by these millions of dollars of bonuses. It doesn't really affect us. Then I asked them, what happens? This was before the financial meltdown. I said, what do you talk about in October, November, and December? They said, nothing but the bonuses. Now, you know, will this happen to everybody? I don't think so. And I don't want to imply that bonuses are always bad. We just need to think about how we take this into account when we design compensations.
Dan Ariely teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. His book on what we've been talking about is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
With unemployment rising and good jobs getting harder to find, let alone the bonuses Dan was just telling us about, you'd think employers would have the advantage in this economy because really, where can a lot of those laid-off workers go? Despite the recession, though, or maybe because of it, there is still plenty of poaching going on, companies trying to lure top performers away from other companies, which means everybody is looking for new and different ways to hold on to the workers they do have. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler starts our story at a company you'd think poaching probably wouldn't be a problem for.
Employees play volleyball at Google's headquarters in Mountain View, California. They're not goofing off, they're innovating. They can think big thoughts while shooting pool, working out with a personal trainer.
One more. All right, fish legs.
We're eating free food at one of Google's restaurants. Google's campus is designed so employees never need to leave. In fact, keeping them has become something of a science.
I can't share too much at this point, but one of the things we're trying to understand is what makes people leave.
That's Laszlo Bock, who heads what Google calls people operations.
It's like human resources, but with math.
Google's mathematicians, statisticians, and psychologists are now trying to anticipate what workers want before they know themselves.
What are the factors that cause people to think about leaving, even if it's subconsciously, before they actually make the decision to leave?
Bock says it depends on the employee. Do they want security, recognition, a sense of community?
What most companies do is they try to give everyone the same thing. And what we're trying to do is figure out, for different folks, what matters to them and deliver that to them.
It doesn't always work. Several top employees have left Google recently. Now that the company has grown to 20,000 workers, it's part of the corporate establishment. And entrepreneurial types, hoping to cash in at a startup, are leaving to find the next Google. Holding on to talent isn't just an issue for the tech industry. It's a growing challenge for banks, especially if they've received government bailout money. With the backlash against bonuses, financial firms in the process of merging have been forced to get more creative to hold on to good people. Bill Willis is a financial headhunter with Willis Consulting. He says when Wells Fargo acquired banking giant Wachovia, it offered some executives incentives tied to performance.
But it's not that hard and fast cash bonus that usually accompanies a merger.
When Morgan Stanley recently merged with Smith Barney, Willis says employees did get retention bonuses. They were just postponed.
That bonus will be paid versus future earnings, hopefully to avoid the controversy of using TARP money.
Without financial incentives, he says some firms are at a competitive disadvantage. Law firms, hoping to preserve their competitive advantage, are trying to keep some employees who haven't even started yet. Several big law firms have delayed the start dates for new associates by a year. A few firms are paying them cash bonuses to wait. Others are taking a different approach. First-year associates at Morgan Lewis and Bacchius typically make about $135,000 a year. Instead, new hires will get $5,000 a month to volunteer with legal aid. Partner Eric Kreutler explains why.
We've invested a lot in this group of law students. Most of them spent a summer working with us. They're extremely talented individuals, and we want to maintain our tie with them.
Legal aid groups get volunteers. The lawyers get experience. That way, Kreutler says, the firm still has a staff on standby.
Our hope is that by the time their start date arrives, that we'll be in the midst of a recovery.
And that no one will have hired their associates away. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, today we talked about Ford earlier, how it's doing well enough to be able to restructure some of its debt. GM, as we know, isn't doing well, that is. So the company is looking for other ways to build up its bank account. The Los Angeles Times found one of them today. GM is in the process of selling off part of its history, what it calls the Heritage Collection, some of the rare and or historic cars it has made over the years. The auction starts Thursday. You can pick up one of the two 1978 Corvette Indy 500 pace cars GM hung on to after the race, or a 1920 Chevrolet Model T truck. GM's hoping to add to the $9 million it raised in a similar sale back in January. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow lost 41 points, 0.5%, 79.75 to close. The NASDAQ retreated 15 points, nearly 1%, ended at 1606. The S&P 500 gave back 7 points, more than 0.75%, ended at 835. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time, how executives are using the recession to clean house.
It is that ripe and that rich for the opportunity to be able to let that individual go who you just haven't been able to figure out a way to let go before.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.